Welcome to Political Rewind. It's 3:06 on Friday afternoon. Thanks for joining us here from our studios in Midtown Atlanta on GPB. I'm Bradley George, filling in for Bill Nigut. He's on vacation. It's the first real vacation he's taken in about 2 years or so. Maybe he's exploring Machu Picchu or hanging out on the beach in Panama City. We really don't know, but we hope he's relaxing, and he'll be back to us in a couple of weeks or so. Joining us today on the panel, we've got Aaron Gould-Shinan, a reporter at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Aaron, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Billy Linville, a longtime Democratic Party consultant and strategist. Billy, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And also with us is Kyle Wingfield, conservative columnist with the AJC. Kyle, thanks for joining us as well.
Yeah, great to be here.
And we're also hoping to have with us a little bit later Ashley Bell. He's a former Hall County commissioner, and he now works on minority engagement efforts for the Republican National Committee. He's going to be joining us by phone, hopefully here in a few minutes. But let's get started. The big political turning point this week was the NBC News Commander-in-Chief Forum on Wednesday night, where Matt Lauer interviewed Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton for about 30 minutes each on some different issues related to national security. There's some remarks from both of the candidates that we'll get into a little bit later. But Aaron, I'm just curious, for you as a journalist, watching that forum, what was going through your mind?
That the setup from the beginning seemed not well thought out for NBC News. First of all, I don't know why you had a Today Show anchor hosting it, not one of your serious news guys. And then, frankly, to discuss who's going to be our next commander-in-chief with 30 minutes with each candidate, and really between commercials and the intros and everything like that, you're probably down to about 25 minutes per candidate. It's just not enough time to answer that question. So the questions were rushed. I thought sometimes the answers were rushed. And it didn't, in defense of Matt Lauer, he's gotten a lot of grief for not hammering Donald Trump a little bit more on some follow-ups. He didn't have time if he had a list of questions he wanted to get to. As a journalist, I actually wrote about it that night. It was a little frustrating.
Yeah, and you could tell the frustration, too, among other NBC journalists on Twitter who were wishing that Lauer would push back on some of the things that both of them were saying. So it was just kind of this weird dissonance. You're watching this NBC News product, but you got NBC News folks saying, "Hey, you need to. Here's some things that are coming up that both candidates are saying that you need to push back on a little bit."
Yeah, it was the first time that the two of these candidates were on the same program, albeit not together. So it had the potential to be really groundbreaking, and in the end, I don't think it was. It just generated a ton of stories, but too many of them are about the style and less are about the substance. And it just didn't have the format, and Lauer didn't either have the gravitas or the time to really follow up and hone in on some of what Trump said particularly.
We've got the first presidential debate coming up in about 2 weeks or so. Billy Linville, watching that forum, did you get any sense of how these candidates might fare once they square off face-to-face in that debate?
Yeah, I think we have a pretty good idea, and I think Aaron alluded to something that's going to be very important in the presidential debates, and that is I think the moderators have to fact-check the candidates. During Donald Trump's interview with Matt Lauer, he was never challenged about saying untruthful things, and I think that's a basic responsibility of a journalist, first of all, is ascertain the truth, and whether it's his support for the Iraq War at the time of the invasion, or other things that he said that were untrue. I think it's an obligation of the panelists in the poll or any journalist doing interviews with candidates that they have to do their homework and hold these candidates accountable to the truth.
Kyle?
Yeah, I'll disagree with that. I mean, first of all, 4 years ago we saw Candy Crowley try to do that during a debate, and it got kind of mangled in the exchange, and in the end she ended up saying that she hadn't quite gotten it right either there. As someone who's moderated a bunch of debates, you've got so many things on your mind, keeping track of time, who's gone first, if you have other people asking questions, whose turn is it to ask next? Trying to fact check someone in that environment with all that going through your head, I think is just really not something that the moderators ought to try to do. Now, if the network wants to try to have someone else who's off camera at that time taking notes and present some sort of fact check at some point during the evening, I don't have a problem with that. But the person asking the questions right there in the middle of the fray, I personally think it's just inviting way too much trouble.
I would just say that in the case of Trump, though, if you know that you're going to ask him about the Iraq War invasion and you know that he's been saying one thing now compared to what he said then it doesn't seem like it's out of the realm of possibility for you to have a clip, an audio clip, a video clip, a piece of paper next to you for when he does answer it that way, that you can just come right back at him.
Sure. That's a fair point. And I think it was one of the Fox News debates during the primary where they would preface a question with a clip of what he or someone else had said at some point in the past and said, you've been saying this on the trail. Here's what you said at the time. You know, how do you reconcile that? That's that to me, that's the way you do it. Because you can anticipate some things that both of them are going to say that fact checkers have been pulling their hair out during this entire campaign, trying to keep on top of.
All right, let's get into a little bit of what the candidates said during this forum. But I want to remind folks, I didn't do this at the beginning. If you want to join the conversation, you can do that on Twitter. We're at PoliticsGPB. That's PoliticsGPB. On Twitter. Now, with regards to what Donald Trump said in this forum, probably one of the things that's gotten the most attention were his comments about Vladimir Putin, Russian President Vladimir Putin. This is a little bit of an exchange that he had with Matt Lauer.
He's also a guy who annexed Crimea, invaded Ukraine, supports Assad in Syria, supports Iran, is trying to undermine our influence in key regions of the world, and according to our intelligence community, probably is the main suspect for the hacking of the DNC computers.
Well, nobody knows that for a fact, but do you want me to start naming some of the things that President Obama does?
But do you want to be complimented by that former KGB officer?
Well, I think when he calls me brilliant, I'll take the compliment, okay?
Okay, so we had that moment. And then last night, Trump appeared on RT, and RT is a broadcaster funded by the Russian government. Larry King has a show on there. He also has a podcast that runs independent of that, but his show is part of the lineup on RT, and there was an interview with Trump on that. And he said in that interview with regard to Vladimir Putin, this is a direct quote from Donald Trump. He says, it's a very different system. He's talking about the Russian political system. I don't happen to like the system, but certainly in that system, he has been a leader far more than our president has been a leader. Kyle, as a conservative, how does that make you feel when you hear Donald Trump say something like that?
I can't stand it. I mean, just to be perfectly honest. I spent 4.5 years in Europe, and I wrote about Russia a lot during that time. And during the time when you had sort of the charade of him, of Putin passing power off to Dmitry Medvedev, and then back. The guy does not have good intentions toward the United States. He thinks the breakup of the Soviet Union was the biggest geopolitical catastrophe of the 20th century. There might be limited things that you could find where he would be a neutral partner, someone who wouldn't be actively trying to undermine you, but on so many other fronts, he is. And I retweeted something earlier today that I just found terrible. It was a YouGov economist poll. From 2014 to 2016, Putin's net favorability among Democrats and Republicans. Among Democrats, he's the same at negative 54. Among Republicans, he's gone from negative 66 to negative 27. Now, he's still seen unfavorably by most Republicans. But I just find it really disturbing that that the party that claims it's the one that won the Cold War with Reagan and it stands for NATO and a strong defense and defending our way of life and that kind of thing, for the standard bearer of that party to be cozying up with somebody like Vladimir Putin, I find it unacceptable.
Billy?
I think this is not just a matter of patriotism. It's a matter of national security. Can you imagine for one moment if Barack Obama, when he was running for president, praised Vladimir Putin and preferred him over our current president, then George W. Bush, and then the following day go on a Russian propaganda television show? I mean, he would have been ran out of the country. And that's what we're seeing now with the leader of the Republican Party. It's a very dangerous situation combined with the fact that he has stated publicly that he may not come to the aid of our NATO partners if there is some type of invasion in Eastern Europe. This is a very dangerous situation. I think it has a lot of legs, and I think serious people, especially conservative national security-focused leaders, are going to be paying a lot of attention to, and it could be one of the critical topics of the presidential campaign.
Billy, you bring up President Obama. I mean, how many conservatives and Republicans went nuts when he was on his visit to Cuba earlier this year and allowed himself to be photographed in front of a mural of Che Guevara? Okay, that was a big deal in Republican and conservative circles for you know, several days.
Well, I'm thinking back to the Nelson Mandela funeral where he shook hands with Raul Castro, and
right.
conservatives went crazy over that.
So there's been this standard that certain leaders of certain countries who don't, you know, who are philosophically opposed to the United States and our way of government and way of life, you're not meant to be cozying up to them. And now we see Donald Trump doing that. So I find it very disturbing.
All right, so that was the flashpoint with Donald Trump. It was one of them. There were a couple of others we could get into. Well, let's move on to Hillary Clinton. She started her part of that forum about 10 minutes or so, the first 10 minutes, answering questions about her use of a private email server. And this is her answer to one of those questions.
Well, I appreciate your concern and also your experience, but let me try to make the distinctions that I think are important for me to answer your question. First, as I said to Matt, you know and I know, classified material is designated, it is marked, there is a header so that there is no dispute at all that what is being communicated to or from someone who has that access is marked classified.
So did we hear anything necessarily new or anything different from Hillary Clinton on her justifications about this email server than we've heard in the past, Aaron?
I didn't really hear anything new. She managed to make it sound a lot more reasonable than I think that maybe it was. For her, it was a smart political answer that probably went over fairly well. It hasn't lasted as people have started picking that answer apart a little bit that, no, it wasn't in the header, but there was the C in parentheses within the copy of the emails that are supposed to designate that as confidential or classified. And what I haven't heard her answer is, when you got to that C in a parentheses in the middle of a email, did you think it was a copyright notice?
She thought it was an alphabetical order marking, is what she told the FBI earlier this year, which is pretty ridiculous. The one new thing, she always has something new in these explanations because she can't keep her story straight. You know, it only took about to the next day when someone dredged up a clip of her previously saying that the headers weren't what really mattered. It was, you know, what was marked inside the email, and we were supposed to, you know, that you know how to handle all this. And so this is why it continues to be an issue for her. And the Washington Post had an editorial, you know, saying that this story is out of control. Well, it's out of control because she can't give a plausible, consistent answer to what she did and why.
Billy, as a Democrat, does any of this concern you?
Well, I think this issue demonstrates that Hillary is not a politician like Bill Clinton or Barack Obama. She just does not have those skills. And I think that this inability to put this issue away or succinctly talk about it is an indication that she is not the candidate that they are. But the bottom line is that the Republican FBI director said there were no crimes committed. And it's time to move on. And, you know, certainly as we're talking about the email scandal, there needs to be as much attention placed on the fact that Donald Trump continually refuses to turn over his tax records, which I think should be as big a story as this minor email scandal.
All right. You're listening to Political Rewind on GPB. I'm Bradley George. And for Bill Nigut, we're here today with Aaron Gould-Shilin of the AJC, Democratic consultant and strategist Billy Linville, and Kyle Wingfield, who's a columnist at the AJC. We're welcoming your feedback at Politics GPB. I'll just read a couple of your tweets here quickly. This is talking about the NBC News Commander-in-Chief Forum. Thought Crime says, why not just let the veterans ask the questions without moderated input? Also, why is it considered improper to hold a former Secretary of State to a greater standard for practice than non-former executives? Welcoming your feedback at Politics GPB. Tell us what you thought about this week's Commander-in-Chief Forum, what you think about Donald Trump's remarks on Vladimir Putin or Hillary Clinton's handling of her ongoing email issues. Coming up, we're going to hear from Ashley Bell, who's helping with minority outreach efforts for the Republican National Committee. It's 3:20. This is Political Rewind on GPB.
GPB Radio is a network of 18 stations, including WJSP, FM, and HD Warm Springs, Columbus, WJWV, FM, and HD Fort Gaines, WXVS, FM, and HD Waycross, WWET, FM and HD Valdosta, WABR, FM and HD Tifton, WNGU, FM and HD Dahlonega, and WSVH, FM and HD Savannah.
Wherever you're listening to us, we're glad you're tuned in to Political Rewind on GPB. And joining us now via telephone is Ashley Bell. He's a former county commissioner in Hall County. He's been involved in Republican politics for a while, and he's now helping with national minority engagement efforts on with the GOP. Ashley, thanks for joining us.
Always a pleasure to be with y'all. Thank you so much for having me.
Glad you're here. You've been in this role for a couple of months now. What have been your focuses with reaching out to minority voters in this election cycle?
Well, you know, is using this opportunity to play to Donald Trump's strengths, because he has strengths that none of our previous nominees have had. Donald Trump is an unconventional candidate, and, you know, so we're not afraid to try unconventional methods. And what you've seen with Donald Trump over the last month and a half is a direct appeal to black voters for their support. Now, that is something just we just haven't seen from, you know, Mitt Romney, didn't see it from John McCain, a direct, blunt saying, look, here's the state of affairs, and here's what I'm offering as a candidate. That's been, you know, coming out of the box, it was something new. People didn't know how to take it. And I think as we see him move forward, he's had 8 events directly meeting with African-Americans, and only 2 of them have gotten any press. And that's primarily because originally the story was going to be, how does he mess this up? How does he, offend people, or how does he say the wrong thing? Well, after the second meeting, the last 4 went fine, and so you haven't heard anything about it. So that's good news for us. No news is good news. So we're still plugging away in battleground states, and we're seeing the numbers change.
I mean, those are individual events, and you can change voters' minds in those individual events. But in terms of making broader changes, and you look at some of the polling, and Trump is his polling numbers with various minority groups. It's in the single digits, or it's in the low double digits. How are you hoping to affect some broader shift with less than 2 months to go till the election?
Well, let me tell you, you know, I think when I started this job, we were at 1% in the margin of error of 3 or 4. So I think that now every poll shows us at least at 5, and in most polls have us around 8, which is several points higher than Mitt Romney and twice as much as John McCain. So listening, you know, I think we'll concede that the beginning of this race, he earned where he was, but he also decided that he did not want to stay where he was. He wanted to invest the resources and the time and the effort to do better, and I think that's what we're seeing. So we're seeing him at 8%. There's some polls in the state of Florida where I am right now that are showing him actually in the teens at one point at 20% with black voters in the state of Florida. The reality is this. Hillary Clinton is the perfect candidate to run against because she is the author of the most devastating policies to African Americans in the history of this country. And from the time President Clinton was in office and she supported his crimes bill, more African Americans were put into federal and state prison during the Clinton administration than at any other time in American history. And when you look at the effects of what many liberals are calling the new Jim Crow, and what many liberals have come out and said they can't support Hillary Clinton because of this, there is an opening for someone to step in and say, look, I'm not just campaigning for your votes today. November 9th, you're still going to be my constituents. I'm still going to be your president, and I'm going to fight for you every day instead of just showing up for elections, as many Democrats do, and then taking a break until the next cycle.
All right. I'm going to let the panel jump in here. I'm going to let Billy Linville go first. I know you've been sitting here listening to Ashley. You've been shaking your head.
Well, I mean, I don't know how Donald Trump is going to get the African-American community to listen to any policy proposal when he was led the movement to say that Barack Obama, the first African-American president, was not a U.S. citizen, that he was actually born in Africa, and questioned his citizenship. So until Donald Trump addresses that issue directly, I don't know how he expects any African-American voter to listen to him. Just like with the Hispanic voters.
Let
me respond to that, because that's a little bit intellectually dishonest. Because, yes, you know, Donald Trump was made some comments that, of course, some African Americans take issue with. But let's be honest with who we're dealing with. Once again, we're dealing with real people on the other side. The Clinton, same Bill Clinton that said after Barack Obama defeated his wife in South Carolina, oh, he won it because he was black. Delegitimizing the fact that he was a candidate that had issues and he was actually resonating with black voters over his wife. So the Clintons are not scot-free here. So if the Democrats' best hope is to play the race card and say, well, Donald Trump doesn't like you, so don't listen to his policies, that would negate the fact that there's too many Americans in this country who are living in inner cities, who are in failed schools, and who are looking for a way out. Too many Americans looking for jobs, who are looking for employment. And with too many people who know their health care went up and is now unaffordable when it was told it would be affordable. So if you can, if you really believe that that argument is so strong that you don't care about your health care, your education, and the economy, I think that you're taking black votes for granted. And that is what we're hoping we're going to need to get the black vote this November.
Kyle, do you want to jump in here?
No, I like watching them go at it. Good to talk to you, though, Ashley.
Yeah. Hey, Ashley, it's Aaron. How you doing?
Hey, Aaron.
So, I mean, if you see polls in Florida that show Donald Trump pulling 20% of the African-American vote, I would be shocked to see that happens come November. I mean, when you're out there down there on the ground in Florida, I mean, who are you meeting with? What do you say to them? And what's the response when you first, like, address the issue? I mean, are they receptive? Are they doubtful? I mean, I would imagine that some of the folks you're going to talk to out of the blue are going to be a little unsure of the message.
No, don't get me wrong. This is an uphill fight for anybody with the letter R after their name. And that is not unique to Donald Trump. That is just
true.
A problem that our party has had, and we recognize that we know we have to overcome. So this election is about two choices. And I think that when people look at the two choices, if you are an establishment Democrat, if you are someone who considers yourself a part of the establishment and you're an African-American voter, you're inclined to support the establishment. However, there is an element of the black populace who believe that the establishment has let them down, that the status quo has not served them, that every civil unrest you see in every major city is because of an establishment that has turned their back on them. And because of that, we have an opportunity to put forth a candidate where we say, look, this is not a politician. This is not someone who's plagued in more scandals than any other person in the history of politics. This is not a Clinton. This is someone who is from the outside who is not going to continue the status quo. Americans, time and time again, will always give a change to the status quo a chance. So the people who are not establishment, who are African-American voters, are listening. They say, all right, well, I know what I get from the Clinton. The same thing in many of the problems we've seen persist in inner cities. What is your plan? And that is why I think Donald Trump's speech on education was so poignant, because many times there are too many – there's nothing people care about more than their kids. And you can't go to someone and say, because you're in a failing school with high crime in that school, if you look at Michael Brown, for example, you take Michael Brown, a situation, you know, a tragic situation in Ferguson. The guy graduated from a high school that didn't have accreditation. Where was he supposed to go to school because his high school didn't have accreditation for him to even apply to college? That story is told too many times. And when Democrats can't go to these parents and say, look, don't worry about that. Donald Trump said something about African-Americans that you might not like. So you should still keep your kids in these failing schools. They're not buying it, and there's too many people who don't.
Well, so Ashley, I'm sure we have minority voters listening right now. I mean, what is Donald Trump's message to him? What is Donald Trump's plan? I mean, we hear a lot from him about how he's going to make schools great. He's going to we'll have the best educational system ever. But what is he going to do?
I think you heard specifically in his speech the money he wanted to dedicate it to school choice to make sure that parents who want to get their kids out of failing schools can move them. I think that's a big step from the federal government.
So it's like vouchers, right? Something like a private school option,
or any school option. Okay. We're not just saying private school option. Okay. We're saying that there's a public school somewhere close by that is better than where you are. You should be able to get out. And him being able to say, we're going to put money in the federal budget to make sure that you're not trapped. That is an option that parents at the end of the day know that the Democratic Party is too tied to unions to even listen to them. And they tell them over and over again, we must keep your money and keep dumping it into a failed system. So you saw a big pivot there from Donald Trump in the past and saying, look, I'm for spending this money because I know at the end of the day, these parents care about their children more than anything. They care about more about their children than any rhetoric that Hillary Clinton or I might say. Let me offer this solution, and that's something the Democrats will never talk about because they're too tied to the unions to offer these real solutions to real people.
Ashley, I'm just wondering, though, is that message any different? Is that any different than we've heard from GOP politicians in the past? I think back to George W. Bush in 2000. I mean, a big part of his compassionate conservative message back then, and No Child Left Behind, a lot of that was tied up in a lot of those same kind of talking points. What necessarily is different about what Trump's proposing versus what GOP politicians have proposed in the past?
I think it's a big difference because what George W. Bush was proposing was more bureaucracy and getting more money to Title I and Title II schools to help them do better. And this approach is not more bureaucrats, not more money going to failing schools per se, but more money giving parents the choice to move their children out of a failing school into a school of their choice. That's a different schematic altogether. So I think that Donald Trump's plan of saying, look, I'm not just going to keep throwing money at this problem. I'm going to give the money to the parents, to the voters, to the families, and say, you choose where is the best place for your child. That's a shift in policy that I think is resonating, and I think that's going to be the key. We don't, you know, we acknowledge we don't need to get 95% of the black vote to make headway here. If we get into the teens, we get into the low 20s, this race is over. And I think the Democrats have a low margin of error. They have to get over 95% of the black vote to win. If we get into the teens, there goes Missouri, there goes Florida, there goes Pennsylvania, and there goes Ohio, and we get to 270.
Well, you're in Florida right now. Where else do you think you could potentially move the needle on African-American voters?
I think Ohio and North Carolina are great places, fertile ground for us. I think Ohio especially has just a history of, honestly, of electing statewide black Republicans. You look at Ken Blackwell, you look at the large black Republican populations in Ohio, the Rust Belt there, a lot of jobs are gone. They want those jobs back. They hear Donald Trump's talk on bringing making America more competitive again. That is resonating for people who are out of work. You look in North Carolina, the same story, and I think in Florida you're still hearing that same story. So in these three states, I think primarily you're going to see a bigger turnout than normal, and you're going to see voters who are not just willing to say, "All right, Democrats, I heard your song, and I want to just replay that tune again." They're tired of it. They want something different, and I think that Americans always vote for change. I admit, Barack Obama was able to still make the election about change against Mitt Romney somehow, and that's how we lost. There's no way that voting for Hillary Clinton is about change. It is an absolute choice to stick with the Secretary of the status quo.
Billy?
Yeah, I just want to close. If Democrats would certainly welcome a debate about strengthening our public education school system rather than weakening it. But also, let me go back to my original point. North Carolina was just brought up. North Carolina, a federal judge threw out their voting law because it was grossly targeting African Americans and senior citizens and the poor from allowing them to vote. And it got overturned by the courts. African Americans, you know, understand what's going on here. They understand the rhetoric that appeals to the white nationalistic right. They understand the language that Donald Trump uses when he describes Mexican Americans and immigrants from Mexico. You can't use that type of hateful rhetoric and then ask those same people for your vote.
Well, I think with North Carolina is an interesting, conversation there because, you know, I think the judge did bring up some points. So I think many Republicans have condemned some of the local Republicans and their rhetoric and some of the tactics that were underlining the legislation. There's nobody defending that. And I agree with that 100% that there were some folks who did not have clean hands in dealing with that. However, if you talk to black people in North Carolina, they'll be the first to tell you, yeah, I didn't like that rhetoric. Those particular Republicans need to be condemned and have been by many other Republicans. But when you look at the numbers, the bill went into place in 2013. More African-Americans voted in 2014 than they did in the previous midterm election. So when you look at the actual effect of the actual bill, more black people actually voted. So the effect was not exactly what people was told it would be. It did not deter anyone from voting, and it may have been a motivator, but at the end of the day, you went up 4% in black vote turnout and voting after the bill was passed.
Ashley, I just want to close this out here. We've seen, of course, the race here in Georgia is close. We've seen visits from Trump surrogates. Any chance you think we're going to see Donald Trump in the state, or we're going to see the campaign put any more assets here?
I wouldn't close the door on that. I think that as we go into the final swing, Georgia is a state we want to make sure is stays red. We're not taking this for granted. And mainly, you know, our job is to consolidate the GOP in Georgia. That's why you saw Governor Pence here. If we consolidate our party, we win this race in Georgia with a comfortable margin. And we got to keep working at it. We don't take that for granted. Recent polls show us now a 90% approval rating amongst Republicans. But we got to get them out to vote. Mitt Romney had 122,000 Republicans stay home. So that race was a lot closer than it should have been. We need those folks back out. And that's why I'm glad we got great leadership with the Georgia GOP who are dedicated to making that happen. And look, these county parties in Georgia are taking it serious. Look at every county party when early voting is about to start in Georgia. They're all making phone calls. They're all knocking on doors. They put the fire god in these county parties in Georgia. So they're working. I expect a good turnout.
All right. That's Ashley Bell, Minority Engagement Director for the Republican National Committee. Ashley, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you all. Y'all have a great weekend. Take care.
Thanks. You too. All right. You're listening to Political Rewind on GPB. It's 3:35 on Friday afternoon. We're going to take a short break here. When we return, we're going to talk a little bit more about the presidential race, and we're going to get into some state matters as well. This is Political Rewind on GPB.
For young people and gangs, disputes that start in the streets spill over to social media.
I got involved in this work because young people were dying based on what they say online.
Desmond Patton sees a chance for intervention.
Social media gives us an opportunity to really dig deeper into these experiences.
Using social media to stop the violence later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered gets underway at 4 o'clock this afternoon right here on GPB.
You're listening to Political Rewind on Georgia Public Broadcasting and 18-station radio network. GPB Atlanta is licensed to Georgia State University, ranked among the top universities in the nation in commitment to undergraduate teaching.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. I'm Bradley George, filling in for Bill Nigut today. Joining us on the panel, Aaron Goldshinen from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Kyle Wingfield from the AJC, and Democratic consultant Billy Linville. So we're about 2 weeks out from the first presidential debate, and we got a question here on Twitter. This is from Cody Hall, and he's asking asking you, the panelists individually, what you think each candidate needs to change or improve before that first debate. Billy, let's start with you.
Well, I think that Hillary Clinton needs to be a little more succinct in her answers, and she needs to be able to pivot off the email situation much better than she's done in the past. But I think she needs to demonstrate her substance. That's what she's known for being very policy-focused, and really show a vision of her America. I think that's the most important thing for her.
Kyle?
It's going to be interesting to watch, because during the primary debates, you know, what Donald Trump said and got a lot of attention. But there were also some long stretches of those debates where he just kind of disappeared, and the other candidates were the ones doing a lot of the speaking.
That happens when you have like 12, 13, 14 but that, people on
that, stage. That happens. No, that's true. But it seemed very noticeable, and maybe it's noticeable because his personality is so large. I don't know. But it's going to be really interesting to see if he can come up with enough substance to fill that greater amount of time that he's going to have, because it is just presumably two candidates on the stage, presuming that the Libertarian and Green Party candidates don't make the 15% threshold to get in there. So he was able to kind of wing it, I think, a lot during the primary debates, and I don't think he's going to be able to get away with that in these debates. So I'll be watching that.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing about the primary debates as well is that they're much more freewheeling than these general election debates. With these events, you have these memorandums of understanding that the candidates the campaigns negotiate, and there's all these rules and there are time limits and there are all these other things, and it's going to be interesting to see how Trump is going to perform in a more restrained and supposedly a more restrained environment.
Well, one of the things, you know, that he did so well in those primary debates that he got so much attention for was his attack mode toward the other candidates, right? Whether it was low energy Jeb or, you know, whomever down the line.
Lying Ted,
yeah, good, whatever you want to do. But if he takes that same sort of tact in the general, I'd be fascinated by the reaction and then by Hillary's response, you know, and then also the format. If they're allowed to question each other, how, you know, what they decide to hone in on, does he ask her about emails? Does she ask him about his taxes or about, you know, what he said about the Iraq war? So much of how these debates are going to go is going to depend on the moderator and the format that they choose. I mean, it's going to be fascinating, but they both have minefields that they're going to have to navigate. But at the end of the day, you almost wonder at this point what Trump can do still at this point to upset his supporters. I mean, you know, I'm not sure
he has a core of supporters. I think right. With the undecideds, with swing voters, that's where the tension is. Billy?
Yeah. I think also we have to keep in mind how historically consequential presidential debates have been in our recent history, whether it's the 1960 debate with Kennedy and Nixon, whether it was Gerald Ford saying that there's no Eastern European domination of the Soviet Union, Ronald Reagan's famous line in the 1980 debate with Jimmy Carter, here you go again, George Bush Senior looking at his watch, These presidential debates have a tendency to really change a trajectory of a campaign. And I think Kyle mentioned the Candy Crowley debate, which was highly consequential in the last election. So these are very, very important events that could determine the outcome.
And I don't think it's unreasonable to say there could be 60, 65, 70 million people watching this. I mean, there will be this. These should be at least the first one, the most watched debates we've ever seen.
All right, so we'll be looking forward to that coming up. What's the for September 26th,
26th.
Monday after next, I believe. Which, wow, this election's going to be over before we know it. Maybe
if
not soon
promise.
Enough for some folks. Yeah, we promise. We promise it'll be over. But then comes 2020 and the 2018 elections here in Georgia. Speaking of Georgia politics, let's talk a little bit about what Governor Nathan Deal said this week. Of course, one of the things on the ballot, probably the most consequential statewide race on the ballot this fall, is the plan that Governor Deal has put forth to allow the state to take over the lowest performing public schools and operate them in a state operated district. There are similar systems already in place in Louisiana and Tennessee. He talked a little bit about that in an education and forum in Atlanta this week. And this is important because we've got a number of school districts across the state, school boards, that are passing resolutions against that. And here are some of Governor Deal's thoughts on that.
How many of those parents who have children in chronically failing schools do you think would be put on the agenda to speak and complain at a local school board meeting? If you think there are very many of those, you have more confidence in the system than I do.
Kyle, education reform, school choice, that's a big issue among conservatives. We heard Ashley Bell talk about that just a few minutes ago. But I'm wondering, with something like this, with the Opportunity School District, with a state coming in and taking over local schools, is there a conservative argument against that? And is that what we're seeing playing out with some of these districts passing resolutions against this proposal?
I think what we're seeing with these school boards is a little bit of the disconnect between the elected class of the Republicans and the voters and the citizens themselves, similar to what we saw in the primary this year with the Donald Trump effect. And the reason I say that is this. The commonality here, yes, there are some Republican stronghold, Cherokee County, their school board, voted for a resolution along these lines. So did Clayton County, which is very much not a Republican stronghold. The commonality here is school districts don't like the idea that they're going to lose control and power and money. And I think for me, and I've argued in favor of the OSD, and I have a column about this in Sunday's paper, to me, this is about how local control ought to be. This has been described as the state taking control away from locals. The way I look at it is, it's the state taking the control that's at the district school board level and handing it further down to the school level, to the principal, to the teachers, to the parents. I went to New Orleans last year on a trip that a lot of legislators took. And when you talk to the school official, the people in the schools themselves, the principals will tell you, I have control over hiring and firing decisions that I never had before. I have control over curriculum and finances that I never had before, because the charter school model has been heavily adopted in their version of this. And I think most people expect that's what would happen here as well. So I think that a lot of there's a lot of frustration even in Republican suburban areas that have, generally speaking, good schools, that people don't always get the responsiveness that they want from their local school officials. And I think the school boards taking this stand might not be reflected in the way their voters approach this.
Aaron, do you think we're going to see, is there any correlation to draw between districts passing these resolutions and how voters may end up deciding the fate of this thing?
I think there will be in some cases, although I was surprised late yesterday, we got an email from the House Communications Office, their Representative Valencia Stovall, who's a Democratic House member from Clayton County. She put out a statement complaining about Clayton County's school board passing that resolution and then announcing that she herself supports the OSD. So, yeah, I mean, between the teachers and the school boards working against this, I mean, that message is going to come down from to the parent level and to the voter level. Obviously, on the other side, you have the supporters doing trying to do the same thing. I'm just going to be surprised to see, you know, like you said at the beginning, it's the biggest issue probably on and from a state issue on the ballot this fall, and it's going to be the only thing that really gets a lot of attention from that sense. So Georgia voters tend to approve constitutional amendments. A lot of people may not know what it's involved, and they'll read that thing and they'll just say yes. So the opponents to this, I think, have a fight ahead of them to counter that. But I'm also kind of curious, you know, the party, the Democratic Party as such, I don't think has really come out one way or another as an entity on this. But I'm curious, you know, how, Billy, you feel about it.
Yeah, Billy.
Well, this is a big deal because it changes Georgia's constitution and gives extraordinary power not just to this governor, but now every future governor. And it really changes the definition of local control. Do local taxes stay local? And what area of influence are parents and neighborhood leaders going to have on their local school? So this is an issue that I think should have been more fully debated during the legislative session, that there should have been forums around the state to really talk this issue through, because it is very important. And at the same time, you know, I think that this is going to force school boards to really address the issue of perpetually troubled schools. I know that Atlanta Superintendent Maria Karstarfin and the board have created their own turnaround strategy that is being praised by Governor
Deal in anticipation
and others. And it looks like it's really going to work and have impact on some schools that really need it. So I think this is healthy in the sense that it is forcing superintendents and school boards to really radically address this issue.
But if you vote that down, that stick goes away. And I think that's what I would say. If no school ever went into the OSD, but that motivation was there for the Atlanta Public Schools and other districts that have responded, and some with failing schools have not responded as strongly, and I do give the APS credit for what they've done, I think it's perfectly fair to say that those things never would have happened, and we shouldn't expect them to happen in the future if this threat is not out there.
Well, speaking of Atlanta Public Schools, it's been interesting to see the comments from Maria Karstarfin, the APS superintendent, and Courtney English, the chair of the Atlanta Board of Education, because they've said, yeah, we don't really like this plan, but we're not going to take this step of passing a resolution against it. So it's interesting to see, you know, they've got this turnaround plan. They don't necessarily like the OSD, but they're not going to draw this line in the sand the way some of these other districts are.
I think what you'll see ultimately from a lot of conservative voters is, yes, they like the concept of local control, and whether you agree with me or not, that the control ends up more local or not with this, I think what they don't necessarily think is that we've seen a lot of local accountability. And I think it's the two go hand in hand. You know, if you're going to have the control, you have to show the responsibility and be held accountable. And people point to, well, the school boards are elected. Yeah, that's true. I would venture to guess that in almost every district, parents of current students represent a significant minority of the voters who participate in those elections. So you might have parent older voters in a community who remember when their kids went through the schools were great. So they, you know, they keep voting for the school board, or, you know, people motivated by whether people are talking about raising taxes or whatever. I'm not sure that the results that we've gotten from our public schools in Georgia bear out the notion that the way control has been wielded at the local level has led to results, and that there's been an accountability for how they've gone about things.
Well, that's not the only amendment on the ballot. Public Service Commissioner Tim Echols just reminded us there's also something called the Safe Harbor Amendment. Aaron, what is that?
That is a constitutional amendment that deals with a couple pieces of legislation passed over the last few years that are aimed at combating child sex trafficking. The legislature passed a couple bills that would force some adult businesses to pay an annual fee or tax, depending on your point of view, to go into a fund that would help fund programs to treat children who are rescued out of child sex trafficking. And the constitutional amendment is necessary because the General Assembly cannot say, we're going to create this new tax, and it's you're going to pay it. Only this group's going to pay it, and it's going to go specifically to a program. The way the Constitution works is all that money has to go into the general fund and be subject to the annual appropriations process every year, which is always a crapshoot as to whether or not that money's going to go where it's intended. So with the constitutional amendment, it'll mandate that the money raised from that fee and from stiffer penalties on people convicted of these crimes can go specifically to the programs that lawmakers want. The two bills passed pretty overwhelmingly, both in the House and the Senate, and obviously the governor signed them, and so this is just the final step.
And Kyle, you want to?
Yeah, and there's an additional one to completely revamp what's called the Judicial Qualifications Commission.
Oh, yes, this one's interesting, too.
Which I was going to say, it was a very esoteric topic until a certain judge in North Georgia decided to try to have a publisher and his attorney thrown in jail over an open records request. And she just happened at the time, and she's since resigned, to be the head of the JQC, as it's called. But now this one's very controversial, too, because you have some people, even though they're skeptical of the way the JQC has worked, who are equally skeptical about the way that this reform was put together and what it would do and who it would empower. So I'm not sure how this one's going to play out. Aaron said that voters tend to approve amendments, and I agree that's generally true. When they don't, it's usually because they can't tell even from the often favorable phrasing of the amendment on the ballot what it's going to do, and there is sometimes a tendency to vote those types of things down, and this could be one of those cases.
Well, the other thing Governor Deal talked about yesterday, right after he gave this education speech, is he talked about pay for law enforcement officers in Georgia, especially those who work for state agencies. And there were raises for that in the budget that were passed this year, and some that are coming in the coming year. Is that correct?
Yeah. So the State Patrol state law enforcement officers got a 6% pay raise in the current fiscal year's budget. What the governor announced yesterday was that all those state law enforcement officers, state troopers, DNR troopers, all down the line, will get a 20% raise starting in January 1st. Now that money's not actually in the budget, but you know he was flanked by House Speaker David Ralston and Lieutenant Governor Casey Cagle, who assured everybody that as soon as they come back to session in January, they'll get to work.
They'll pass the mid-year budget.
Pass the mid-year budget and have money in there for it. It was quite a moment, and I actually had a great talk yesterday afternoon while I was leaving my office at the Capitol, walking to my car. I fell in line with a state trooper, and I told him, "I said, man, it's a great day for you today, huh?" And he said, "Well, every day is a great day." And I said, "Well, it's a little bit more so, isn't it?" And he said, "Well," he didn't know what I was talking about. I said, "You haven't heard what the governor said today?" And he said, "No." And I said, "The Governor Deal announced that all state law enforcement officers were getting a 20% pay raise." And he just stopped in the middle of the sidewalk and turned and put his hand on my arm and said, 20%? And he said, "I can get my air conditioning fixed now." He said his air conditioning had gone out the night before, and he didn't know how he was going to pay for it. So, I mean, it's for a lot of those troopers, who's the median salary was $35,000 a year. A 20% raise, I mean, is life-changing.
And this is something the AJC has reported on extensively, particularly issues of staffing with the Georgia State Patrol. Mm-hmm. They can't keep officers. They have a lot of recruits who wash out in the training process. But also part of it is that the fact that the starting salary is just abysmal when you look at other law enforcement agencies, when you look at their peers at other states.
Yeah, we reported this morning that there are 8 municipalities or local governments in Georgia that have higher starting salaries for their police than the state patrol.
Yeah, the other piece of the announcement yesterday was additional training for police officers throughout the state to deal with. And the governor said it wasn't a direct reaction to some of what we've seen around the country, but certainly, I mean, the context for this is these clashes that we've unfortunately seen in some parts of the country between police and citizens. And sometimes the police were in the wrong, and sometimes maybe the citizens had done something they shouldn't have done. But to put an emphasis on that community policing aspect, getting officers to understand the communities they work in better, maybe certain groups of people that live in those communities get to have some cultural training there, and just to really, the one thing that you hear from law enforcement that they believe works is when the police know the people they're policing and when they're trained better to know how to respond to certain situations, and that piece of it certainly seems geared at preventing stuff like that from happening here.
Yeah,
Bill,
yeah, I think in addition to what Kyle said, training around technology is so important today too, because now police officers need body cameras because if they're not filming themselves, someone else may be. And I think that'll go a long way toward addressing trust issues and conduct on both sides.
One of the things that they emphasized was that a lot of the training is going to be on de-escalation, mm-hmm. right? It's not just on, you know, on right or wrong, but it's getting into a situation and how do you diffuse it before it gets out of hand. And Vernon Keenan, the GBI director, told me yesterday that state law enforcement training is like anything else. It has to be adapted and updated to reflect the times, and that Georgia's was in bad need of an update.
All right. Just in the last couple of minutes here, I want to go back and read some of the tweets we got at Politics GPB over the course of the show. Got great feedback today. Douglas Hooker, talking about the Opportunity School District Amendment, says it gives unchecked power to the governor. He says schools aren't failing because of local control. He put local in quotes. They're failing because of state funding and property segregation. Looking at a tweet from Jeffrey McLaughlin talking about Donald Trump, given his core platform involves appeals to a counter-revolution to absolute white rule. There's a low ceiling for that. T-Barf says that he is a never-Hillary guy and that he would like to feature Her America. I don't know what that is. I guess it's some kind of anti-Hillary film or something or other. More feedback. You can read it for yourself at Politics GPB. We also have a poll up that's pretty popular. We're asking a simple question, Vladimir Putin, American friend or foe? You can find that at our Twitter account, Politics GPB. And later this month, we're going to give you another chance to get involved in the conversation as well. We're going to have another Political Rewind with a voter panel. We did this a couple of weeks ago, and it was a really good success. You can get on this as well. If you want to be on the show, tell us why you think your opinion is worth hearing and why you'd be good for the show. The number is 678-757-4472. That's 678-757-4472 if you want to be part of our voter panel, and you may be part of the show coming up in a couple of weeks. Thanks to our panel today, Aaron Gould-Scheinen of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, Kyle Wingfield of the AJC, and Billy Linville. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
We're out of time today. A big thanks to the panel. Again, thanks to all of you who were responding to us on Twitter as well. Thanks as well to our senior producer. That's Jenny Amet, producer Trevor Young. Our intern is Robert Jemison. Running the board is Tyler Morris. Tune in next Wednesday for another Political Rewind. And my colleague Ricky Bevington, she will be the guest host, and it should be an interesting conversation as well. That's coming up next Wednesday afternoon at 2. I'm Bradley George. Thanks so much for listening to Political Rewind. Stay tuned for All Things Considered coming up next on your GPB station. I'm Bradley George. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend.